From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin explains why she must vote yes on impeaching President Trump.
And if I lose my seat, I will at least have lost it knowing that I did what I thought was right, and that is the most I can do.
We check in with the longest-serving exoneree in U.S. history, how Richard Phillips avoided anger and bitterness after being wrongly imprisoned for nearly five decades.
If you carry around bitterness long enough, it's going to turn you into a bitter person. Me, I'm not trying to be bitter. I'm just trying to enjoy life.
And exploring history and economics with two of my favorite stateside guests.
History, economics, political science, sociology, the boundaries between these disciplines are, in a lot of cases, kind of fuzzy because they all interact with each other.
Those stories and more on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we check in with Richard Phillips. He is the longest-serving exoneree in U.S. history. We'll talk with him about what life's been like after 2 years of freedom. But first, this week, the House of Representatives will decide whether Donald Trump becomes just the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. Early today, Democrats released a 658-page report accusing the president of wire fraud and criminal bribery. This report explains the two articles of impeachment the full House will consider Wednesday. And it puts enormous pressure on the 31 Democratic representatives who were elected in Trump districts. And that includes the congresswoman from Michigan's 8th District. Representative Alyssa Slotkin is here with us now. You have reached your decision on impeachment. You're going to vote yes on both articles. So first, the abuse of power. Why are you voting yes?
Well, you know, for me, this was a process that started back in September when I came out along with six of my peers with a national security background in support of an inquiry. And we did that because, frankly, the facts of the Ukraine situation just felt fundamentally different to me than all the other things that had come before that. And it speaks to why I'm voting yes this week. That very basic idea that the president of the United States reached out to a foreigner and asked for an investigation of a political rival, asked for help for personal political gain and not for the national security of the United States. That very basic idea that the president acknowledged when he was asked by a reporter, that the president's lawyer said on TV, and that a whole bunch of witnesses and sworn testimony accounted for, to me, that represents a body of information to support that idea. And I just cannot accept that a president gets to do that without being checked. And, you know, I did what I was trained to do as a CIA analyst. I sat this past weekend at my farm in Holly and just pulled out hard copies of the articles and of impeachment and the reports and the rebuttal reports from the Republicans. I went back and looked at historical documents, the impeachment documents that Nixon and Clinton had. I went back to the founding documents of our country, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, which speak specifically to impeachment. And I did what I was trained to do, take a stand-back approach and make an objective decision based on a body of information. So that's why I'm voting yes on both articles.
And what about obstruction of Congress? What reasons drive you to vote yes?
Well, this one was pretty simple. I mean, you literally go to the Constitution and it gives the House of Representatives sole responsibility for impeachment. And I understand the president doesn't like that this is happening, but his decision, which really breaks with 100 years of tradition, where he said, you know what, we're not answering subpoenas, I'm not letting people come and testify, I'm not providing any witnesses, I'm not going to participate in this process, is actually not his choice. This is the way the balance of powers was set up by our founding fathers. And Nixon participated, Clinton participated way back when President Johnson participated, Andrew Johnson. And for me, the president, this is for me very clear that he was obstructing Congress. He would not let us. And frankly, I think it wasn't good for our normal checks and balances in our system, but it also wasn't good because people really wanted to hear his side of the story. You know, I think there's a lot of people who want to understand his take on this, and we didn't hear that. He just protested the entire process.
It is interesting as you think of arguments that have been presented by Republicans. A big one is he was looking into corruption in Ukraine, that he cared about that past history of corruption in Ukraine.
I don't think that's reflected in the information that was provided. I think we know from just a number of people who came and testified, including Ambassador Sondland, who is the president's ambassador, his chosen ambassador to the European Union, that the president was reaching out to the Ukrainians for two things. One, for an investigation of the Biden family, and two, for details and information on how Ukraine engaged in the 2016 election. And that latter idea has been widely dispelled by the intelligence community. The idea that it was Ukraine and not Russia that meddled in our 2016 election is a fabrication of the Russian intelligence organizations. That's something that Congress has been briefed on by all the representatives of the intelligence community, and is not accurate. So I don't think that this was a genuine attempt by the president to clean up corruption in Ukraine. I think that we have quite a mountain of evidence that says this was about him gaining political advantage in an American election, and I cannot abide that.
I'm speaking with Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin of the 8th District, who announced today that she will be voting yes on both articles of impeachment this week against President Trump. And I know you held a town hall meeting early today, Congressman, to announce your decision. How do you answer your constituents who believe wholeheartedly that this president has been railroaded and the impeachment inquiry has ignored the voice and the will of voters who put him in office?
Yeah, so we had a big town hall today, I think over 400 people. It was standing room only here at Oakland University. This is our fifth town hall since I came out in support of an impeachment inquiry, because I think it is my responsibility to stand in front of my constituents, even if we don't always agree, and explain my logic and hear from them and answer their questions. So, you know, I don't know if a lot of my peers are having town halls to announce their decision, but for me, this was an extremely important part of what I'm doing here. So we had that today, and there were indeed people protesting in the back of the room, and there were lots of folks who don't like the impeachment inquiry that were sitting throughout the audience. And for me, in terms of the question of whether the process was biased or didn't involve the other side, just to be clear, facts still matter. And throughout this process, the Republicans have been present in every moment of these hearings, both when they were classified and unclassified. They got just as much time to ask questions. They were able to request subpoenas. They were a part of this process both when it was private and then obviously when it was public. Everyone could watch it on television. And I understand that there are a number of folks who feel like the process wasn't fair, but it did follow the rules as laid out in the Constitution. And I think that is an important piece for me as we move forward.
Are you prepared to lose your seat over this?
That I certainly get that brought up to me every time I do an interview, and that's gone on for, you know, 12 weeks now. And obviously, I would like to continue to be the representative for the 8th District. That is my honor and is my hope for 2020. But I was never planning on being an elected official. This was not my path, and I'm not going to compromise my integrity just to win an election. If I listened only to political pollsters or consultants or all that stuff, and all I cared about was winning in the 8th District in November, then I wouldn't have come out and supported an inquiry, right? But I did, and I support and will vote yes on these articles, even though it's politically controversial, because I have to look at myself in the mirror when I wake up in the morning. And if I lose my seat, I will at least have lost it knowing that I did what I thought was right, and that is the most I can do.
Groups supporting Republicans in Congress have been hammering you pretty hard over impeachment in TV and print ads and on social media. Are you getting the funding and messaging support that you need from the Democratic Party leadership to counter these attacks?
Well, there's definitely been some positive ads, I guess, to contrast against the negative ads, but it is definitely clear that the Republicans are outspending us something like 6-1 on those attack ads. And, you know, obviously no one likes having their dad turn on the TV and see an attack ad against their kid. I can't say I like them, but I trust the voters. And I believe that especially Michigan voters want people who believe in integrity and in decency and in civility. And I would always love if folks wanted to help us out and put things on social media that talk about more positive views of us, but I can't make my decisions based on attack ads and how much money is being spent against me. That's just not the way I'm wired.
In our final few moments, I just interested in your thoughts on what might happen in the Senate when you now have Majority Leader Mitch McConnell telling everyone, I'm working hand in glove with the White House and there is no way President Trump will be removed. If everything that has been put out through these impeachment hearings has not seemed to have changed any minds in the Senate and the president is not removed, what did our country gain from all of this in your view?
Yeah. So, you know, unfortunately, our founding fathers had set up impeachment so that the House sort of prosecutes the case, the Senate is the jury, and that's how the system's supposed to work. So obviously the jury working with the defendant isn't exactly how our founding fathers set it up, and I was a little sad to see Senator McConnell come out and sort of admit that. I mean, I think even just as a parochial person that he would want to maintain the roles and responsibilities of the Senate and not just hand them over to the White House. But I think it's a fair assessment that the Senate will acquit the president. To me, I know that it's frustrated a lot of people to have these hearings, but there just had to be a mark on the ground when the president reached out to foreigners for his own personal political gain. We just can't let that go unanswered. Because today it could be a Republican president reaching out to the Ukrainians. Tomorrow it could be a Democratic president reaching out to the North Koreans or the Chinese. Like, it just can't be normal to invite foreigners to participate in the most sacred democratic institution we have. And so while it may not accomplish the goals that some people set out for it, I do think it was important now and for precedent-setting reasons that we put down a marker.
Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we check in with Richard Phillips, the longest-serving exoneree in U.S. history.
I've tried to do everything that I can to make the system, and not only just the system, but human life better for as many people as I possibly can.
That is next here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Before I end my time hosting this program, there are some special guests that I want to catch up with, people whose stories I could not get out of my mind and my heart. And one of those special people is here now. He spent over 46 years in prison in Michigan for murder he did not commit. The Michigan Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School took up his case, and the result? Richard Phillips walked out of prison in 2017, and in 2018, he was exonerated, his record wiped clean. He is the longest-serving exoneree in U.S. history, so no one else in this country has done more time in prison for a crime he did not commit. Richard Phillips is back with us again, and welcome back to the studio, Richard.
How are you doing today?
I am doing very well, and I am happy to see you. And I have to tell you, as I prepare to retire, one of the questions I get asked most often is, what's your favorite interview? What interview really sticks with you? And every time I say Richard Phillips. So I want to thank you for coming in to talk one last time. First and foremost, how are you doing?
Right now, life is good. God is good. He's treated me kindly over the last 2 years since I've been released. I've had so many miraculous experiences. I've met so many miraculous and wonderful people. I've been introduced into so many different families that have fallen in love with me and that I've fallen in love with.
I would imagine if I was in some legal trouble and was feeling caught in this net, looking at someone like you who could say, look, listen to me here, has got to be a very important thing.
Well, actually, it's important to receive that information from me, because I've actually had to go through the whole process. You know, I've done nearly 50 years in prison for a crime that I didn't do. And so once I looked at the system, I seen that there are so many different things involved in the system that could be changed, things that can be corrected, policies that can be changed and implemented, you know, to make the system better and make it more fair and just for everybody that's involved.
One thing, Richard, real quickly, that I want to figure out and find out about as we talked the last time. When we last talked, you were still waiting to be compensated by the state. Has the state settled with you yet?
In terms of the settlement, I would say this. The state have actually given me some form of compensation in order to live with, and I'm satisfied with that. I was never really interested in money, no way. Money was never my primary reason for getting out. I just wanted my freedom. Mm-hmm. My freedom was more important to me than anything, money, anything else.
But you got out and you had to build this life after you'd been away for almost 5 decades from scratch.
That's very true. And I'm still building this life. But right now, life is good for me.
Yes.
I've been enjoying it. I've been trying to give back. I've been trying to help those that are unfortunate. I've tried to do everything that I can to make the system, and not only just the system, but human life better for as many people as I possibly can.
I remember being struck by your artistic talent, which you discovered while you were in prison. And when we last talked, you were kind of supporting yourself by selling paintings. So where are you at in terms of your art now?
In terms of my art right now, I've kind of backed off on actually creating art, because I have such an array of collection of art to be sold, and those are still online. I sell mostly prints now, because, you know, I was advised that in order to maintain some semblance of keeping history, you know, those paintings are involved in history. I mean, you've already given the public an example of my being the only exoneree to have served as much time as I have in United States history. So my art is actually connected in historical terms. So therefore, I've really been selling prints, and that's primarily where I'm at in terms of selling art right now. I guess I would get to a point where, as though once I get comfortable, and right now I'm at work, so I'm working every day. So I, you know,
you're
I
have, busy.
Yeah, so I don't really have a chance to really be involved in the things that I really love to do, which is art. But eventually, I'm sure that I'll probably venture back to it at some point.
Have you gotten, Richard Phillips, to a point where you have been able to shake off or put aside whatever feelings or habits that you carried with you from those decades in prison?
Well, being in prison for all those years, you run through a process of development within yourself. Me, I had to go through all types of development. I had to come to grips with the fact that I was somewhat uneducated. And so one of my first decisions was to get my GED. Because in this world, you need an education in order to actually live and survive. Without that, you don't have the necessary tools that you need in order to become successful in life. If you want a job, then you're going to have to know how to do the job. You have to either be talented, skilled before you even go into a job, or you won't be able to do that job as well as you should. And so me, I felt that getting an education would be important in the event that I ever got released from prison. I didn't know whether I was going to live or die in there. As fortunate as happened, God opened the door for me and allowed me to enjoy some of the later years of my life. And right now, basically, other than me being involved in the different programs, the Innocence Projects and things that I'm involved in, I'm just really trying to be happy and live life. I don't really want a whole lot of fanfare. I'm not trying to be a movie star. I'm not trying to explain to people about this and that. I'm just trying to live my life and enjoy what little life I do have left on this earth.
You went in when you were how old?
I was 25.
And you came out at age?
72. Okay. I am now going on 74.
One of the things is I thought about our conversations and I thought about your story. And certainly my family and I have talked about this, because what's striking is you were not filled with the red hot anger that I think I would have been carrying had I been wrongly convicted and locked up for nearly half a century. How did you not give in to that very understandable reaction?
Well, in my estimation, if you carry around bitterness long enough, it's going to turn you into a bitter person. Me, I'm not trying to be bitter. I'm just trying to enjoy life, fill out the rest of my life with as much happiness and love as I possibly can.
Did you carry that for a while in prison?
I tried to stay to myself a lot in prison. That way, the anger that I felt, the disappointment of losing my family and my children and my life, so to speak, you know, didn't really filter in as much because I tried to keep my mind occupied with other things, my art, writing poetry, writing letters, doing all types of other things that were positive in order to stay away from the negative, which was my feelings and missing my children. Those things were heart-wrenching. I mean, can you imagine someone just taking your child from you and just going to another country or another world and you never seeing them again for almost 47 years? Can you imagine that?
I cannot.
Okay, well, that's what happened to me. So I had to endure those thoughts, and I had to try to cloud them out in order to be able to endure the madness that I was seeing every day. And prison is not a place that you want to be. I can guarantee you that. No matter who you are or where you come from, you do not want to spend one day in prison. Some people can't stand 10 hours before they hang themselves. That's a fact. But listen, if you can get through the hard times, I think God will make it possible for you to enjoy some good times. At least He has for me, and I'm grateful for that.
You know, I've got to imagine, as you say, you want to live your life and build this life. And at the same time, I kind of feel here's this position you have in legal history. It has put you in the spotlight. How has that been for you?
Well, the attention is good and bad. I get to meet a lot of wonderful people. In the 2 years that I've been out, it seems as though I've lived 50 years in the last 2 years. I've met so many different people, representatives. I've spoken in Lansing. I've been to conventions in other states. I've spoken at churches. I've tried to advise anybody and everybody to enjoy life and live and appreciate the life that you have. Because God didn't promise any of us a rose garden. You know, He said, listen, here's life. Go take it and do the best you can with it. If you're going to have hard times, you're not going to always have good times. So you have to learn how to adjust in life and go through it. And I went through my adjustment period, which was prison. Mm-hmm. Now the good times are rolling in. I'm surrounded by people that I love. They've turned me from someone that was close to being a derelict. Because when I got out, I didn't have any assistance from anybody. I could have been a bum on the street. But there were people involved in my life, even the people I've never had a chance to thank those people that sent me money from the GoFundMe program. But those people that know who they are, those people that did contribute, I thank them and love them from the bottom of my heart. I've never had a chance to actually thank them, but I do.
They can hear you say
that. They can hear me now.
We all suffer injustices. Yours put you in the history books.
Right.
But I think as we listen to your thoughts and watch you build this life, we can all learn about how to put something in its place. And I guess I'm curious, is what you found, Richard Phillips, is it a state of forgiveness? Is it acceptance? Is it something else?
I think it's a little bit of everything. You have to accept those things that happen to you. You have to make changes in your life at certain points in your life. You have to do those things that are necessary in order to go forward, to put one foot in front of the next, and to make it to another day. There were times in prison where I didn't really think that I'd be able to get up the next day. But luckily enough, through the grace of God, I was always able to climb out of bed, put one foot in front of the other, and make it through the day. And that's what all of us have to do. We have to go through whatever we're going through, deal with it, and keep it moving. And if we can do that, we'll be successful in the end, because I think that at some point, God comes into all our lives and makes it better. I didn't think it would ever happen to me because I was confined in a cold, dark cell for almost a half a century. But it just goes to show, things can change. You just have to hang in there until it does.
Richard Phillips, we wish you a very, very happy 2020 as you look forward to new things in the new year. And I want to thank you for being part of my final week on Stateside.
I would also like to say this. This is almost like a bittersweet moment for me because I'm happy for the fact that you're going to be going off into the wild blue land yonder enjoying your life. But I'm also sad, and I'm sad for your listeners as well, because here you are, you've put in almost 40 years of being the voice of reason, the voice of the constant motherly love type people that want to hear you speak every day. There's people that get up and turn on the radio show just to hear you speak and get confidence and reassurance in life from you. And it's going to be heartbreaking for us to lose out on that voice. I'm, for one, going to be heartbroken at the fact that I don't know if I'll ever see you again, but you and I have become good friends. And I've learned to care for you just as much as my other friends. And it's good to see you again, believe me.
Thank you, Richard. Now, you've made me cry. Nobody's done that until now. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
Time for one of my favorite stateside moments, when I get to say, hey, let's talk a little sports with Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubank. And it's so funny, John, to think some things don't change. We've been talking for years about the dismal outlook for Lions fans. And guess what? We're still talking about the dismal outlook for the Lions and their fans.
I was trying to think about this. You started 7 years ago, of course, on stateside. Yeah. Been a great run. And by the way, this show was a wild card when it started. Yeah. Now it's considered an obvious idea, but not at the time. It was bold and brave and all that good stuff. And you and Steve and Zoe and Joe and company have all done a great job. But I think you and I started doing our regular talks, I think about 3 or 4 years ago.
Makes sense.
Mainly on Mondays.
We talked about your books first, yep. And then we started saying, we're having fun. Let's talk sports.
Well, also what impressed me, listeners, is she actually read the doggone books. This is not always the case in this business. So that impressed me. But let's see. 3 or 4 years ago, we started talking. The Wings stunk, the Lions stunk, the Tigers stunk, and the Pistons stunk. And, well, here we are.
And?
Boom, boom, boom.
Ditto, ditto, ditto.
Let's save some time. All true.
All true. But, you know, do you think, as many are suggesting, it's time for Matt Patricia and Bob Quinn to go?
Hard call. Look, it's only Quinn's third year, I believe, yeah. And it's middle of a second year for Matt Patricia.
But things are going backwards.
You hate to pull the plug that fast. Mm. Probably the first time, really. The Lions hired bona fide professionals and winning programs from the New England Patriots. That's the pretty obvious hire they've made in their whole tenure, frankly. And it's not working. More shocking, perhaps, is the defense stinks. That is Matt Patricia's specialty with the Patriots, who win Super Bowls with those defenses. The only reason I'm saying it's not yet because their pedigrees and because it's so early in their tenures. But the results, if they fired them, I would not say you're wrong.
Mm. Now, what about our wings? As you think about between Steve Yzerman at the helm and some of these young, still developing players, could one look ahead and see a hint of future glory? Or
absolutely. Based on Yzerman, not on Blashill. Blashill is in year, what, 4 now?
At least.
5?
Yeah.
And I've not seen any progress in any way from his team. I grant you the roster is thin, but so what? Then play tough. Then play defense. Mm-hmm. Defense is for the asking, frankly. That's coaching. Offense, you need skill. Defense is discipline, and they don't have it. I think that Yzerman is probably waiting until it makes sense to make a change. But Steve Yzerman has led the Canadian Olympic team to a gold medal. He has led Tampa Bay to the Stanley Cup Finals. He knows exactly what he's doing, and that is the only franchise I have any faith in right now based on one man, Steve Yzerman.
And certainly he has the goodwill of Wings fans who would elect him governor if they could, I think.
Not a bad idea, maybe.
Real quickly, looking to those upcoming bowl games, first with the Citrus Bowl and U of M facing Alabama. Fourth meeting between Michigan and Alabama in the bowl season, and Wolverines hold a 2-1 advantage. What are you predicting?
Well, everyone is predicting Alabama is going to roll over the Wolverines. Last time they played was 41-14. Granted, that was under Brady Hoke.
Yeah.
However, in the current bowl scenario, we don't know which Alabama players are going to sign up for this bowl game. Those with pro potential, which is half that team at least, might say, see you later. This is the Citrus Bowl, after all. It's not the Rose Bowl. It's not the playoffs they're used to.
I am not risking my NFL career.
Exactly right. So until I find out who's playing for which team, I can't guess much. If Michigan simply gets rid of the self-inflicted mistakes they made against Ohio State, they could have a chance against anybody.
Now, MSU facing Wake Forest in the Pinstripe Bowl December 27th.
Who knows?
What has to happen for both teams looking ahead?
I think Michigan solved their biggest problem midseason, and that is their offense. That Josh Gattis figured out how to drive this car, and he's now on the sidelines instead of the press box, which is where he needs to be for this team, at least. They've got great quarterbacks coming back in Dylan McCaffrey and Joe Milton. I think the future is bright for Michigan. The question is, can they finally crack Ohio State? And they've only come close a couple times, so Michigan State, the $64 million, not $1,000 question is, does Mark D'Antonio come back? If he does come back, does he come back for another year in the same regime, or does he get serious about changing his offensive coaching staff? Because that is going nowhere.
Okay, we'll watch for that. So listen, I have to say thank you, John Bacon, because it started with my reading your book, Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football, which if y'all listening have not read, do, because you beautifully show us what's in the hearts of these kids who play for pride and play for their teams. And that sparked it. And now my husband has somebody who watches games with him and cheers and yells. And you did that conversion, and I want to thank you.
Well, you're very kind, but of course, you did that conversion. You can give these books to anybody, and if they don't get them, they don't get them. The beauty part here, and I hope the listeners appreciate this, you often did more homework than I did going into these shows. You'd spend half an hour to an hour composing 5 minutes of questions. When you asked a question, you'd throw it in there. You knew my strike zone. You let me swing the bat. Sports metaphors, sorry, and run the bases. You've got the Johnny Carson trick of letting the guest be the star. And that's true with me and Dan House and Howard Markel and you name it.
Because you are. I'm here to help you share your wisdom with our listeners.
I'm going to quote my dad on this one. Do you admire the sunset or do you admire yourself admiring the sunset? Mm. And too often in journalism, it's the interviewer trying to show off how cool and smart they are. And you simply enjoy the story coming in. I get so many comments from our five-minute segments on Mondays. And it's wonderful for me because the most common comment I get is, I don't care about sports, but I like this. Because you've got the knack, the insight, that Jim Bernstein, a guy you've talked to, Michigan screenwriting director, founder, as well as Mighty Ducks, Renaissance Man, some other credits to his name. He said, if a sports movie is about sports, it stinks. Mm-hmm. Because who cares? The games have already happened. It has to be about people, values, and conflicts. And once we get into that stuff, then we have a story. It happens to be a story that is about sports. And you got that always, and you're wonderful to talk to and become a great friend.
Back at you, and I know it'll be easier for us to meet for dinners somewhere between point A and point B, and I will look forward to reading your future books and whatever you're doing. I wish you and your beautiful family, to Christy and to Teddy, just the best of everything.
Well, thank you very much. We're not done. We're done with radio, but we're not done.
All right. Fair enough. John Eubacon, thank you.
Thank you, Cindy.
After the break, two more of my favorite stateside guests. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the very best things, in fact, the very best thing about being the host of Stateside for more than 7 years is talking to and meeting so many interesting, smart, accomplished people. And also often I'd come back to the Stateside office and I would say to the producer team, I just had the best time talking to so-and-so. Boy, would it be cool to get some of these folks around the table at a dinner party, sit them down, pour wine, and talk about anything and everything. So on this final week of my broadcasting career, we have lined up a few dream dinner party conversations with some of our favorite guests and friends. Today, we have Gleaves Whitmey, director of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University, and Michigan State University professor of economics, Charlie Ballard. Hello to both of you.
Hi, there,
hi, Cindy.
I'm so glad you were both able to join me because I have really, really enjoyed talking with you over the years here on Stateside. You know, and as we talked, I quickly realized you are both very fun to talk to, and you have a gift for making your subjects of history and economics super, super interesting. You know, Charlie, when you were just starting school and still figuring things out, was being an economist and teaching in a university, is that what you had in mind?
Well, I got pretty close to that by the time that I was a junior in college. In my sophomore year in college, I took a course from the late Wallace Oates, a great professor, and that really changed my life. And I learned a lot in that and really enjoyed it. And I thought, hey, that might be a career. And so pretty soon I started asking my faculty members about what it would be like to go to graduate school in economics, and they gave me advice. Now, the hardest part was that my mother had been planning for me to be an attorney, I think since the day I was born.
Wow.
And so when I was a teenager, every time there was an attorney in the room, I would get to introduce to him. And so at some point, I knew that I was going to have to explain to my mother that I didn't think I was going to go to law school. And I was afraid that that she might die, but she didn't. And sure enough, by about 3 years later, she had enrolled in law school.
She did it.
If the kid wasn't going to do it, by golly, somebody in our family is going to be a lawyer. And my mom, I think she passed the bar when she was 55 years old.
That is super, super inspiring. Gleaves, how about you? I mean, the idea of your focus on presidential history, when you were back, before you really landed on it, what did you think you were going to be?
Well, I really thought that history was always fascinating. I grew up in Texas, and of course, Texans have this sense of history because of the Alamo and the Battle of San Jacinto and all this. And so I was always fascinated to understand the past. And I understood by the time I was an undergraduate with great, great teachers that history is the lab of the human experience. And you can see everything that humans attempt to do, fail to do, succeed. And I just thought it was a lot of fun to learn about those things. And it made me a lot more interesting. And let me say, you know, since you were hosting this dinner party, and you host a heck of a great party, Cindy, it's precisely at times like this when I can appreciate what my professors tried to instill in me, and that was a broad liberal education so that I could address whatever the topic was that was thrown out on the table. What was the human experience with that topic, with freedom, with equality, with, well, like Charlie's Field, with trying to generate wealth and what you do in a world of scarce resources? I mean, this is just a intrinsically fascinating thing to do.
When I think about both of your fields and my career path, because if you had seen me my freshman year of college at the then University of Detroit, I would have never believed I would have been sitting here at the end of 40 years in broadcasting. I wanted to be a physician. I was in pre-med, and I was weeping my way through calculus and weeping my way through inorganic chemistry. And no matter how hard I would study, I would get a C. If I didn't, I'd get a C. And if I killed myself studying, I got a C. But meantime, history was, it was like delicious to go to class. And so by my sophomore year, I'd moved over to a history major. And I remember my senior year was the big aha moment when it all connected. So my macroeconomics class connected with the psychology class, which connected with the history. And that moment of, wow, realizing how everything connects. And that was the liberal arts moment that I agree with you. It kind of gets you ready to be able to say something about and understand how we're connected.
You're maybe not a physician of the human body, but you're a physician of the soul of the body politic. I mean, this is what historians can be.
You know, that's the wonderful thing about the social sciences is that they're all connected. Mm-hmm. History, economics, political science, sociology, the boundaries between these disciplines are, in a lot of cases, kind of fuzzy because they all interact with each other. And that's one of the things that I've always loved about my career is that I'm able to bring a historical and institutional and political perspective to thinking about economic issues, which I think is a really fun thing to do.
And I've got to imagine helps make it alive for the kids. And it made me wonder, just as you think of working with kids, what is the secret sauce that you both find to take a subject that in other hands would put people to sleep, but it makes it alive and interesting?
Well, one of the things, speaking for myself, that I try to do is I try to internalize what I want to say before I actually go before an audience. So I might have notes to refer to if I just want to stay on track, but I'd go in there with the stories and the analytical points I want to make, and I try to get away from the lectern. I stand in front of the audience. It can be a little scary sometimes, but you just look them in the eye and you take their questions, you read their body language, and you can tell when you're hitting on all eight cylinders, and then the stories are firing their imagination, and that to me is the most satisfying thing to do. And it's not just the youngins that this works with. I also teach a number of classes at Aquinas College, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute over there for older learners. They're, I think, 50 years up, and they are hungry to learn history, and that changes the dynamic as well. So many times they come up to me after class and they say, you know, I goofed off in history, or my coach was my history teacher in high school. I didn't appreciate history, and now that I'm 60, 70 years old, I'm hungry to understand where we've been so I can figure out where we're going.
Do you remember your first time in front of a class, which I'm betting probably happened when you were grad students, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Were you scared?
Well, I'm an introvert, and believe it or not, I'm really pretty shy. I mean, if I have a job to do, then I can become my extrovert persona, but that's because I have a job in public to do. But by nature, I am not somebody who likes to get out there and do that kind of thing. But again, you give me a job as a teacher, I really enjoy that because it's about the students. And one of the things I learned really early on, and again, I credit mentors who said this, my mentor in teaching my first class said, remember, the students already know an amazing amount, and your job is to bring out through everyday experiences they've had the lessons you're trying to impart. And so by having a more open forum, so it's not just a long lecture format with the students would be entering the conversation, and that's when they started to really learn from each other, and I would learn too.
Did you feel, Charlie, when you come on and talk economics with us, it's just, this is, as you say, firing on all cylinders. Did it take a while to kind of build that that ability?
Absolutely. I think it's like almost all human activities. You get better with practice. You asked whether I was scared. Yeah, I was scared. First time I got up in front of a class, which I think was in 1981, I hadn't had previous experience, I think I did okay, but I've learned so many things since then about how to connect with an audience, how to present the material, and so I think, you know, that's the reason that the veterans contribute more to their sports team than the rookies, and that's the reason why the more experienced in almost any walk of life, experience makes a big difference.
Fun. Charlie, I'm just thinking of what you said. You and I are the same vintage because my first experience in a classroom was also 1981. And, you know, a question that I get, and Charlie, I wonder if you get this question a lot too. You know, students were different. Well, they were all like Cindy in those days. You know, intellectually curious. No, I'm exaggerating a little bit. Cindy would have been the A-plus student.
I was definitely in the front row.
You were definitely
waving
in the front
my
row.
Hand.
We know that. But but there have been changes. Charlie and I have had a chance now to look at a couple of different generations go through the system, mm-hmm. and they reflect really profound changes in our country.
What kind of changes? What have you seen?
I think you and I probably both would agree that the social platforms, you know, social media have had an enormous impact on the way students learn.
Yeah, I would say that the biggest thing that has improved our students' ability to learn has been the presence of all of these digital technologies that did not exist when I started teaching. But I will also say that the biggest thing that has harmed our students' ability to learn is all of these digital technologies. I mean, one of the big challenges that I have is that I know that there are students who are surfing the web on their phone when they should be paying attention to what's going on in class. So it's both a huge plus and a huge minus. You know, Gleaves, before we go on, you not only are we contemporaries, but you said you're from Texas. Well, I grew up in Texas, too. Where are you from?
I'm from Houston.
Houston? City of Houston?
Yes.
Well, I grew up in Lake Jackson. You know where Lake Jackson
is? Yes, I do. You were just a little bit southwest.
Just south of me. About 45 minutes to an hour due south of Houston.
Listen to that speech change as you start talking about being southeast.
I guess, me a Lone Star beer and we're both going to be talking like this in no time.
All right. All right, sure enough.
What?
Cindy, you did a great job putting two people next to each other.
Your speech is, you know, you're like my husband when he goes back to Ireland. We've had him over here now. He came here. I met him in school when I was a junior. I did my junior year at University College Cork. I came home with a Cork inflection, which every time I go back, I get a vaccination. But he came over here to marry me in February of 1976. So when he goes back to Cork, he gets a lot of teasing about sounding like a Yank. But you can hear it come out, especially watching sports. And suddenly you're like, all right, bye. And you hear that Cork accent coming out. But you just morphed. It was delicious to hear.
Well, pretty soon we'll be eating red beans and rice and collard greens.
I love it. Real quick, I'm interested in, for each of you, who's your personal hero?
Oh, gosh.
Charlie, why don't you take that one first?
Well, I have a lot of heroes, but I think I would put Abraham Lincoln at the top of the list.
Why is that?
Well, a whole bunch of reasons. One, I think he's the most important, the greatest president we've ever had. Certainly no other president faced the challenges that he did, the challenge of trying to preserve something like a democracy in the midst of a civil war. But there's more than that. I'm actually distantly related to Abraham Lincoln. I think he's something like a sixth cousin once removed or something. But more than that, even more than that, my one of my great-great-grandfathers served in the 26th Texas Cavalry Regiment. You can tell if you know your geography. Mm-hmm. He was on the losing side.
Yes, he was wearing the butternut color.
His wife gave birth in July of 1865, that is 3 months after Abraham Lincoln died, gave birth to a son, and they gave him the middle name Lincoln as an emblem, I believe, of their belief that the war was over and it was time to bind up the nation's wounds. Mm-hmm. And then 3 generations later, Lincoln is my middle name.
Awesome. I love that story. How about you, Gleaves? Who's your personal hero?
Well, first of all, let me say, I think that's really neat. And Charlie, you'll know what I'm talking about when I say, you know, when we were growing up down in Texas, it was hard to praise Lincoln. And one of the biggest transformations in my education was actually, you know, after coming up north and going to graduate school at the University of Michigan and reading the incredible literature that had been produced about Lincoln that had sort of been contraband in the public schools in Houston to some extent. And so I really, my hat's off to you. And I had no idea you had that personal connection, Charlie. But I would say, going back a little bit further, I'd go back to George Washington, because here's somebody who knew how to handle power and how to let go, relinquish power when he had to. And that's just the kind of person you want to be a president or the leader of your people, as somebody who doesn't need the power. Now, when he was a young man, of course, he was ambitious. But remember, he resigned his commission from the Continental Army in 1783, right after the British surrendered and signed that Paris Peace Accord. He stepped back after the Constitutional Convention of 1787. He spoke very rarely, just a couple of times, points of order during the proceedings themselves. He did not try to dominate it. It was understood he would be the first president, but I mean, he did not lord it over people. And then, of course, he only wanted that first term, but he was prevailed upon to run again as president of the United States. So he did just a wonderful service to posterity by saying, I will not run again. 2 terms is enough. You need to find new and vigorous young leadership. So that is a lesson, I think, for the ages. And in fact, if I can just tell you a quick story about that, King George III was having his portrait painted. Artist named West was painting the portrait, and West was trying to explain to King George III that Washington was somebody who could relinquish power, and he went through all the ways that Washington had stepped back. This fierce man, this man with a fierce temper. I mean, there's nothing milquetoast about him at all. But when it came to Republican principle and stepping back from power, Washington had it. So George III is listening to this, and he said, "If all that you say is true, then George Washington's the greatest man who's ever lived."
Interesting. And actually, as you're talking about this, it reminds me how skillfully Lin-Manuel Miranda kind of worked that into Hamilton, because you have King George saying, I wasn't aware that was a thing a person could do, what he heard. And I think one of the high points of that play, of that musical, is one last time. We're going to teach him how to say goodbye. And it kind of expressing all of that in today's music. That's fabulous.
Gleaves, don't you? I mean, I think historians are in general agreement that Washington's decision to step down after 2 terms was one of the most important turning points in all of American history.
Yes, that's true, and it became sort of just an unconventional rule. It wasn't written down anyplace. It wasn't codified anywhere where presidents were afraid to run for more than 2 terms. Grant, for example, considered it, but then he wisely backed off running for a 3rd term. And of course, FDR then is the one who actually does it in 1940 when mm-hmm. the nation is on the precipice of war. And he knew he could get away with it at that point.
We could do this all night. You are too fun, both of you. Thank you. Thank you so much for giving us your time over the years while I was here on Stateside. The show continues, but I will be listening at home as you get called to contribute to Stateside. But this has been terrific. Leaves Whitney with Grand Valley State University, where he directs the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies, and Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard. Thank you so much for being part of my dinner conversation.
And congratulations to you, Cindy, for 40 years of just wonderful public service to us all.
Thank you.
I'm going to miss you.
Thanks. Thanks for the great work that you and your team at Michigan Radio do. It's really been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we continue my dinner party conversations, this time with politicians Congressman Dan Kildee and the former Speaker of the Michigan House, Paul Hiligans. We'll talk about the paths they took into politics and how we might rebuild an atmosphere of bipartisanship in a divided country. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.